Welcome to the Consulting and Conversations podcast at UBS Private Wealth Management in West Palm Beach. My name is John Castronuovo, a private wealth advisor and one of the senior members on our team. Joining me today is Catherine McDermott. Catherine is an executive director and senior wealth planning strategist in the advanced planning group here at UBS. Today, we will be exploring the sunsetting in 2025 of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Great. How are you, John?
Great. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get started on today's topic, for our listeners, tell us a little bit about your role, the Advanced Planning Group's role, and how you work with teams such as ours here at UBS.
Sure. So I am a former practicing trust and estates attorney. I have a master's in tax law from NYU. And my role here at UBS on the advanced planning team is to partner with our advisors to understand the plans our clients have put into place, to understand the implications for our clients of those plans. We do not draft documents. We don't replace their attorneys. And we do not do tax returns or give tax advice. We're in a planning role and a supportive role.
We're going to focus today, as I mentioned at the beginning, on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which passed in 2017. That law sunsets in 2025. For our listeners, first of all, what does that mean, the law sunsetting? What happens?
So interestingly, that law, when enacted, made a number of tax law changes, but most of those changes were not permanent. There's a complex voting requirement to make a permanent tax law change, and there weren't enough votes to make all the laws permanent at that time. And so a number of the provisions under the TCJA do expire at the end of 2025. So I like to say on January 1st, 2026, we're going to have a new tax law in many regards. And there are a lot of provisions that expire at that time.
One of those big provisions that expires is right now the current exemption, the current lifetime exemption, which is $13.6 million, will go back to $5 million, but then index for inflation back to the 2017 level.
Correct. Yeah, this is something that we discuss quite often with our clients, because many of our clients are concerned about estate taxes. Estate taxes are taxes that they're not like income taxes that you pay each year, but this is a tax that is due upon the death of a taxpayer. If you're married, it's usually upon the death of the survivor of the married couple. The law currently allows an amount to be passed with your lifetime exemption. And that amount, you're correct, this year is $13.61 million. And when the TCJA expires, that's going to revert to about $5 million index for inflation. We're not really sure what that inflation adjustment's going to be, but it's going to be about half of what the exemption is today. And the tax rate above that exemption amount is 40%. It's a very big moving target for our clients to plan around.
Here we are, we're sitting here, it's, you know, as we're recording this broadcast, it's 2024, the law sunsets at the end of 2025. Some clients would probably say, that's far off at this point, we still have an election to go through, whatever, why should I be concerned about this now? Why do I need to address this now? I mean, what would you say to people like that?
When I'm working with clients, I feel that there's a big, you have a lot of options in addressing these types of issues, and understanding all your options is really takes time, especially for some of our clients tend to do their basic estate planning or even some of their advanced estate planning and put those documents in a drawer and they don't review them periodically, which I absolutely encourage clients to do. Some attorneys say to review those plans every 3 years. We try to do it every year or two, depending on what's happening in the client's life. And I do think that if you haven't evaluated all the options to address this potential tax law change, having this time and place is critical. You can marry your balance sheet to potential options, and we can do some forecasts. You know, what if I did this? What if I did that? How are these trusts crafted? Now, these are documents that do have implications for our heirs, how they access funds, who's in control, what am I going to put into those trusts if I'm going to use trusts at all. There are so many different nuances to all those choices that starting early is going to give our clients an advantage in terms of their comfort level with the strategies. The other thing is that when clients wait, there are going to be a lot of very busy trust and estate attorneys drafting documents late in this cycle, and they may not have capacity. If you want to get ahead of that, it's probably best to pick up the phone and talk to your accountant, talk to your attorney. You may have to hire an appraiser to value hard-to-value assets. They are also going to be very busy. Many clients are getting ahead of that now.
And as we know, as professionals get busier, to make it a priority tends to and add to the expense.
Absolutely.
Right. Besides the return to the $5 million exemption indexed for inflation, what other areas will change with the sunsetting?
There are a number of other potential tax law changes. And I think some of the ones that I'm hearing the most about have to do with individual tax rates. The highest marginal tax rate currently is 37%. And on January 1st, 2026, that's scheduled to revert back to 39.6%. So that's going to have an impact on a lot of our clients and on decisions they make in 2025, you know, to accelerate deductions, take in income perhaps in 2025, or push off deductions to 2026. So maybe some clients are going to think about converting IRAs to Roth IRAs prior to this change of the tax law. Also, the standard deduction nearly doubled under the TCJA. That's going to go back to about half of what it currently is. And that's going to have a big impact on taxpayers because you find today that fewer taxpayers itemize deductions because the standard deduction is so generous. Mm. They may change the way they do their tax return. This could have a lot of impact. The other itemized deduction that had changed under the TCJA was the SALT deduction, which was state and local income tax deduction, was capped at $10,000. And this had a significant impact on taxpayers in high tax states. This is going to be going away on January 1st, 2026, and this will allow a greater benefit from deduction for mortgage interest and other local tax like property taxes.
Okay, thank you. As we look at tax planning and estate planning historically, I recall in 2021, some planning professionals were recommending utilizing the then current lifetime exemption by the end of the year, as they thought exemption amounts could be changed by Congress at the time. As we know, that didn't happen. However, there was a big rush because of some of those recommendations to people to do some planning at that point. Is there a downside to doing some planning now, anticipating a possible change, only to have the current law just remain as is after 2026, or exemption and tax rates become even more favorable?
I hate to say it depends, but it really truly does depend on the client situation. For clients that have a net worth that is significantly greater than the current exemption amount, and if they're a married couple, they have their exemption plus their spouse's exemption, it may nevertheless make a great deal of sense to do the gifting. For clients who don't have that delta above the current exemption amount, there are some hard questions that they may need to ask themselves. Because one thing you do give up if you make a gift, you're giving away your current cost basis for your asset. And so if you're giving into a trust, that trust does not get a step up in cost basis at your later death. The appreciation on the asset you gifted is outside of your estate, but you are giving up the step up in basis that you would have if you owned the asset in your estate. And so there are implications that we have to consider for each client and each individual and family. We often look for assets that we can gift that we have a high conviction value are going to appreciate in the future. We also generally look for assets that may be hard to value assets. In the eyes of an appraiser, we might be able to have certain valuation discounts for lack of marketability and lack of control applied when the appraisal is done for those assets. And this can soften the blow of no longer having that step up in cost basis, or at least balance out the equation in favor of gifting. And so I would say it definitely depends. Some clients don't have assets that are hard to value, and so they're looking at gifting marketable securities. And if they gift those marketable securities and they have a low cost basis, they would be giving up the step up in basis at their death. We can run the numbers and make a decision, but that's another reason to start early and try to understand the particulars of the client's situation.
Right. And with that in mind, you mentioned hard to value assets. Obviously, that would include closely held businesses, and especially at this time, as business owners are looking at the succession planning, is also to take into account what's the value of that business. Am I above that exemption amount? So now, therefore, should I be taking advantage of what's going on and what the exemption amount is now to do some of my planning? Doesn't necessarily mean you're giving up total control of the business, but at least you're taking advantage of what the exemption amount that you're afforded today.
Exactly.
This isn't the first time that tax legislation has had a sunsetting provision. In fact, you mentioned earlier about the reasoning for doing that makes it easier to pass in Congress because it doesn't take as many votes if you have a sunsetting provision versus making it permanent. We all remember in 2010 when there was no estate tax because the previous law had sunsetted, and we went through 2010 and there's plenty of familiar names to all of us that we could talk about that passed tremendous assets onto their families without any estate tax at the time. But how can clients build flexibility into their estate plans to minimize impact as revisions to the law occur in the future?
That is a great question, and we work very hard on that. Within bounds, it is possible to build quite a lot of flexibility into estate documents. However, these irrevocable trusts that where you are gifting away the asset, you are making a gift. And so I would always counsel a client, you can't take that back. However, we can build trusts that, for instance, if a beneficiary, maybe a spouse is the beneficiary, the grantor may have backdoor access to those funds through the spouse as long as they're married and their spouse is alive. The spouse could also have the ability to appoint assets in the trust to charity. So sometimes these wealth transfer transactions become more successful than our clients dreamed, and the beneficiaries of the trust are going to have quite a large amount of assets available to them in that trust, more than our clients intended. And so having that ability to appoint assets to charity can become very important to them, leaving open optionality. There are certain states where there might be an opportunity to have a beneficiary added to a trust. There's ways to build in some flexibility. But in general, I definitely counsel clients when making a gift like this that we need to really be ready to part with the asset. Trust law is complex, and we need to have a team around us to really understand all the implications. Some of the implications are also potentially income tax implications. These trusts are often set up so that our client, the grantor, is taxed for income tax purposes on the trust assets. Not universally, we can set them up so that the trust pays the income taxes or the beneficiaries if there's a distribution made. But we need to do a lot of modeling to make sure our clients are comfortable with that. It's, as a tax planner, we see that as a great opportunity to pay the income taxes on the trust for the next generation. But we want to make sure our clients are comfortable with that as well.
You mentioned charitable planning and incorporating that into, obviously that can be a topic unto itself for discussion and something that we'll probably pursue on a future podcast too. But in a sense, when it comes to the charitable piece, what additional opportunities that open up for a client? Because I know a lot of times when I'm talking to clients and we're talking about planning and we start having the charitable discussion, initially, some people that might not have done a lot of charitable gifting in the past just say, well, that's not me, that's not my focus. but what are the benefits? And in some personal experiences you've had, what can you share maybe with clients you've consulted with that might not have considered charitable gifting that incorporated into their plan and then made it a more successful plan by doing so?
Wow, that's a big question. You're right. We could have a whole podcast about that. But I guess I will just say what I find is often our clients are already being quite charitable. Sometimes they are reactive and they're asked by someone in the community to make a donation, so they write a check. They're not necessarily being proactive or thoughtful in, is this the most efficient way to construct my charitable giving plan? And it may start with just setting up a donor advised fund, which is an account that is treated as a public charity for tax purposes. Our clients can then sweep in appreciated stock or assets into that type of account. Donor advised funds often will also take more complex assets. So we've worked with clients who've transferred interest in closely held companies, real estate, et cetera. So that's also a possibility. If that's done with sufficient lead time, you know, if there's no sale imminent for that closely held asset, the client, if that asset is later sold by that donor advised fund, the capital gains tax is not due with respect to the portion of the assets held in the donor advised fund. Our client gets a deduction and the charity eventually will get their distribution. The client has a lot of flexibility on when distributions are made from a donor advised fund. There's no mandatory payout. I do tend to see our clients using those funds actively to make the charitable gifts that they would have made from their personal checking account. Right. You know, they're doing the same level of gifting. That's one way, but in their estate planning and in that context, we're often using charity to be a part of the long-term giving of the whole family. And so our clients often involve children and grandchildren in that giving context because by the time the charities will receive the funds, they are not going to be here if it's part of their estate plan. And so getting their children and next generation involved is key. And we have a number of vehicles that we can use. It can be very advantageous from a tax perspective, but it's also part of that family values conversation and long-term plan to build cohesiveness for the family.
In all this planning that is occurring now, it's going to be occurring as in lead up to the sunsetting of the law. What do you feel? Are there any pieces that you think people aren't paying attention to? And we talked about the glaring ones that stick out, the exemption change. But are there any pieces that you feel like clients really aren't paying any attention to, or even planning professionals for that matter, that we should be paying more attention to?
I've found recently that I have a lot of clients who are working hard to understand the different types of vehicles they can set up. And a lot of the conversations we have with their professionals will involve various types of trusts, how those trusts would be crafted, who would be the beneficiaries, what jurisdiction would they be set up in. Then we get to what are we going to transfer? And it's sometimes not part of that initial conversation, but it's really key. What are you going to give and how is it titled today? Okay. Because the grantor needs to have title to those assets. And sometimes we're planning with families where there's two spouses and titling isn't necessarily thought of until later in the game, but we really need to be thinking of it early in this discussion.
Okay. So let's talk for a minute about life insurance. I know sometimes, you know, that's another topic that clients either want to discuss or they don't want to discuss at all. But there are a lot of benefits to incorporating that into planning, and especially in light of what the upcoming changes are. Talk for a minute about how clients can utilize incorporating life insurance into their overall planning.
Sure. Well, we always want to review what our clients have and kind of take a snapshot of where they are today. They may make no changes to their plan, but if we see that there's life insurance as part of the overall balance sheet or the trust balance sheet, we're going to ask to review those policies, and we have professionals we can bring in to review them from a product to make sure the product is the right product. In the context of the change in the tax law, life insurance could be an opportunity to reposition those policies. Some policies that clients have today maybe were set up more for retirement purposes. You know, I can borrow from the cash value, and the policies could be sitting on our client's estate tax balance sheet and includable in their estate for estate tax purposes. And those clients might consider, you know, hey, I don't need that for retirement purposes anymore, but maybe I can use the cash value to buy more death benefit in this policy or in another policy, and I will move it into a trust outside of my taxable estate. I have other clients that just haven't used as life insurance to fund estate taxes as much as maybe we calculate they have a large estate tax and they could use more life insurance as one alternative, and they might be more comfortable doing that rather than making such a large gift. These exemptions are so high today, and some clients aren't ready to part with those assets and make that gift, but they can leverage life insurance. You know, they might use some of their lifetime exemption rather than the annual exclusion, which incidentally, the annual exclusion is now $18,000. This is an amount that you can gift per year per beneficiary and is often used in life insurance context to pay premiums, but some clients would like to pay a premium that would exceed the number of annual exclusions they could use in a trust because it's basically per beneficiary. And sometimes if you're married, you can double your annual exclusion gifts if you're splitting gifts with your spouse. But if you're making a large purchase of life insurance, you might use some of your lifetime exemption, pay it over a number of years, maybe over the next 2 years, and fund the life insurance that way. So that's something I'm seeing some clients do, mostly because they don't want to part with the assets and they can leverage the insurance.
Right. Thank you. You gave a little explanation for your group and how we work together here at UBS. Give a sense to our listeners in terms of the size of your group and how you complement each other in terms of areas.
Well, I could speak about the advanced planning group. We have at least 25 professionals across the country who specialize in the technical review of our clients' plans and work together with their accountant and their attorney to vet all sorts of ideas that our clients are presented with or that we bring to them or that their attorney brings to them. And we really do a lot of analysis on which assets to pick and what the numbers will look like, what the impact will be, reviewing the actual trust documents to make sure that they're as flexible as possible. We also work very closely with our family advisory and philanthropy team, and they are a group of professionals that really deal with families over generations, those discussions around communication, stewardship of wealth, preparing our next generation for receiving this wealth, facilitating conversations among family members about family values, history, and philanthropy. And they also work very much with clients on their philanthropic projects. So they're very familiar with a number of families that might have similar ideas at the client that we might be working with. And so it's great to bring them in to facilitate discussion and analysis there. And we partner with our clients' insurance advisors and investment advisors. Obviously, all the financial advisors are hearing every day about what clients are doing once they have these structures set up. Clients' lives are very active and they're going to be investing in different businesses and in different types of assets. And where is the appropriate location for that investment? Is it in a multi-generational trust, or is it on the client's personal balance sheet, or is it a mix of the two? We answer a lot of questions like that too.
Okay, great. And before we wrap up, we have a tradition on our podcast anyway of always asking just a personal light question. You and I have worked together now for a number of years, but maybe share some little tidbit about you we don't know, some little trivia thing that might be interesting to all of us to know about you.
I'm also a parent. I have three teenage daughters, so I am familiar with trying to educate the next generation about financial matters. And I have a funny story about my oldest daughter who recently started to drive. I asked her, do you know how much it would cost to put air in your tires? And she said, I don't know, $100? And I said, oh my gosh, I failed.
Here's a new business idea.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you. And thank you so much, Catherine, for joining us today on the podcast. And we appreciate your time and, of course, your partnership in working with us on these things. Thank you for listening in, and thank you, Catherine, for joining me today. You can find our podcast on Apple and Spotify or through our website, advisors.ubs.com/Palm Beach Private Wealth. We look forward to connecting with you all again soon.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.